This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is America's preeminent film critic, Pauline Kael. She's reviewed movies for the New Yorker magazine since 1968. Pauline Kael has never been the I give it four stars, I laugh till I cried type consumer guide critic, and she's rejected the academic style of film theorists. She's passionate about movies. She's defended them against highbrows who dismiss movies as inconsequential entertainments, and against middlebrows who won't endorse a film unless it has an uplifting message. Kael's opinionated, colloquial style of writing has influenced critics in all the arts. She wrote her first published review in 1953, then became a film critic for Pacifica radio station KPFA. For several years, she ran a repertory cinema in San Francisco. It wasn't until she was in her mid-40s that she started making her living as a film critic. Since 1965, Kael's reviews have been collected and published in a series of books. Her latest, State of the Art, is published by Dutton. Kael says that in the 1970s, when people met her, they'd say, "You're so lucky you get to see all the movies." In the 80s, movies have gotten so bad, people say, "It's a shame you have to sit through all those films."
Well, everybody knows how bad recent movies have been, except some of the critics, I think. If you look at the blurbs in the newspapers, the quotes in the ads, you get the feeling that the city is plastered with masterpieces. And then when you go to see those movies, there's just nothing there to watch.
Do you really feel like movies are getting worse? And if so, what's changing them?
Well, I wrote a long piece on why are movies so bad a few years ago, and I hoped that things would begin to turn around by now, but they haven't. We lost a whole generation of really great American directors to the 70s somehow. They were wonderful during the post-Vietnam period and during Vietnam itself and during the Watergate period. They seemed to be charged up. They had real themes. They had things they wanted to say. I mean, directors like Coppola and Martin Scorsese, Altman, they were booming, and innovative, marvelous things were happening in American movies. And then whether they're as confused as everybody else and they simply have nothing to say at the moment, or whether they succumb to a kind of general state of confusion and passivity, I don't know what it is. I do think that drugs have taken a toll on many of the brightest directors. But also, it's the fact that they just don't know what their movies should be about anymore. And in this kind of happy family, grinning era, it's not very easy to be a movie director. The same problem has tackled the novelists. They seem to be in a stranglehold. But I think we feel it more in popular culture.
With movies, it's easy to think that affluence and power removes people from the kind of direct experience that gave them their themes in the first place.
I think that's true, but I also think, a lot of it is the entourage, the privileges, but so many of these people had ideas just popping out of them in the 70s. And in the 80s, you go to see their films, and they're empty exercises in style. Or they've really gone over to the enemy. You know, they'll make films that are just like everybody else's movies. Hollywood is always drawn to what's popular, to what's meaningful in the culture. And right now we have Reagan there and the whole happy family look. And it's very hard not to be influenced by that. You'll see it in a movie like Eleni, which is all about how we love our children. And when the mother talks to her daughter, all she wants to tell her daughter is how great motherhood is going to be. It's almost as if we were living in Nazi Germany in terms of the kind of happy mood of everything in movies. And when people suffer, it tends to be because they're victims of communist repression. And we're getting more and more of that Cold War sentiment in movies, in action films, but also in some of the more serious movies.
You also talk about the infantilization of movies. What do you mean by that?
Well, movies are treating us as if we were children, and they're shaped toward a younger audience than the actual movie audience. The success of the National Lampoon movies swung the industry behind movies that treat us as if we were all 15 and worried about our first sex or worried about the aftermath of our first sex. And, of course, the effect of George Lucas's success has just been enormous on the culture. Here's this perfectly decent, inventive person who's had the worst influence on American movies of anybody I can think of. The success of the Star Wars movies has really poisoned the culture. And Steve Spielberg, a brilliantly gifted movie maker, seems to have an infantile approach to life.
You say that if he wants to make movies about normal life, the only normal experiences he had was when he was a child.
That's right. But, you know, there's a great importance to finding good material and directing it. Unfortunately, the amazing stories sequence on television, the whole series of shows, is all based on his story ideas. And he's never been a great story idea man. They seem to be all reworkings of material that he saw in 40s television or in 40s movies that he caught up with later. He's too young to have seen it at the time, but he's caught up with that, and his head is full of World War II patriotic sentiments. So, you know, he'll have a brilliant episode on Amazing Stories, brilliantly conceived and executed, but the fundamental mysticism and silliness in it just, you know, you're floored at the end when you realize that somebody that bright had nothing more in his head.
How do you see your role as a film critic in terms of the audience that you're writing to, the industry that you're writing about, the artists you're writing about, and the medium, you know, the medium of film?
Well, when I write, I don't think about all that. Uh-huh. I think about trying to get straight what I saw and what it means, what's it about, and what's good in it, what's awful in it. You know, trying to sort those things out in my own head as I write. But beyond that, there are larger things at work. One of them is that the critic is the only voice between the advertiser and the public. And if we're out of the way, the advertisers drown you. And they drown you anyway. But we try to intercept that sometimes. So that if there's a good small movie, the only way you'll hear a word of it is if some critics make a noise.
You write your reviews in a very colloquial style. Did you ever have to unlearn academic style? Because I know you went to college, you were a philosophy major.
That's right. Oh, sure. I had to unlearn all the ways in which we impressed our professors by using big words and fancy references. I tried to learn to write in an American style. I mean, to bring writing more in keeping with how we actually talk about the movies after we've seen them. And it took a while. At first, I was very tight, and it took some doing to loosen all that up and to feel free enough to write the way I talk. I wanted it to have the same rhythm as my spoken word, because I thought it was false to write in a different rhythm from the way I talked. And I felt that if I could do it, you know, make them one, that I might have an honest way of responding to movies. It's one of the reasons I like James Agee's criticism, because the passionate way that he wrote was truer to how we really respond to movies than the sort of cool, fake, objective style you see in most critics who are respected.
When you review a movie, you usually only see it once.
That's right.
Do you trust that initial reaction?
I think it's the best reaction I'll ever have. And I don't mean that other people need to work the way I do, but I work best that way, because when I see a movie the first time, it has all the suspense and excitement intact in it. And I think when people go back over and over, they really try to see in the movie what other people have told them is in it. And even if they didn't like it, they often, you know, begin to fake their own responses to themselves. Because there is a consensus opinion that advertising and prestige develop around a certain picture, even before it opens to the public. We all know what the industry's pushing, what each company is betting on, and from the time of year they open it and how they handle it, we know, you know, what's behind it. And a lot of people fall into line with that. And if they don't really like the movie the first time, they go back. And then the second time, they convince themselves that they see more in it. Often they've done an interview with the director or the stars before they've even seen it. And so they've been told all the great things that are in it. I think it's very important not to interview anybody connected with the movie before you see it, to go and then write about what you yourself reacted to from what was on the screen, and not look for that marvelous performance you've been told about. Very often it isn't there. Anyway, I simply like that full immediate experience, and I'm able to recall the movie very well from one seeing. So the only times I've ever gone back was when the review was already locked in and I needed to check that I've got a quotation straight or that I got some point right about where a scene took place, something of that sort. So I might do that just before it's locked in at the printers, but I always write the review from the first seeing.
Do you ever go back a second time and find that second opinion is very different from the first, and maybe you begin to doubt that first opinion?
No, I don't think a movie review is fatal. I don't do any great damage to a movie by not liking it, particularly if it's a big movie. If it's a small, innovative movie or small budget movie, if I don't like it, I generally don't say so anyway. I just don't review the movie. I think the big ones, it's fair to go after if they're dogs. But the little ones, I let get away anyway. So I don't think I can do any great damage to a movie. And you know, there are independent-minded people out there who often don't respond the way the big press tells them to anyway. In New York, the awful thing is the power of the New York Times, and particularly not the regular critics so much as that arts and leisure section on Sunday, which gives a cultural patina to so many boring movies from Europe, or to, you know, Truffaut made so many bad movies at the end, and each one was treated as if it was another masterpiece. And not everybody falls for that. There are people who are smart enough to see through it, but there are a lot of people who go to movies for cultural purposes, and they tend to trust the Sunday Times Arts and Leisure section, and they get stung every time, and I don't think they even know it. I mean, they got stung on all those boring Fassbinder movies that they went to regularly, two or three a year. Those movies that were so sloppily made and so insulting. And it's just amazing how many people were treating them as masterpieces. But of course, they didn't really travel throughout the country or have any particular effect on the culture. The big ones that amaze me, the big ones that get by, are movies like Ghostbusters and Beverly Hills Cop, because those were huge successes. I mean, among the greatest box office films of all time. And they're really very, very mediocre movies that just happen to catch a public mood at the moment. I mean, in the case of Bill Murray, he'd made a much better film the year before called Stripes. And that, although it was a success, wasn't nearly in the class of Ghostbusters. Well, a critic can't fight that kind of success. There's nothing you can do about it. All you can do is try to, and this is where your role comes in, try to analyze it as coolly as you can so that at least people out there will know they're not crazy if they didn't like it either.
You're a very influential film critic, especially among people who are very serious about movies and among other film critics, I think. But I don't know how influential the industry thinks of you as being. You're not on the Today Show, and you're not a consumer guide. type critic. Does the industry and do publicists try to court your favor and make sure that they place a, you know, a review in the New Yorker that you cover their film?
Some do. A lot don't. A lot of them would just assume I didn't see the movies, and a number of them systematically don't invite me. And very often on certain pictures, they don't invite me. They make a guess in advance. They're very often wrong. But no, I mean, it works both ways. They just assume I didn't see a picture. I never get invited as early as Time and Newsweek. I very often am asked the day before it opens, and I say, thanks, I'll go see it at the theater tomorrow. It's a matter of courting certain magazines that they feel they can trust more than others. And I just assume not be in their good graces. On the other hand, I think that a lot of people in Los Angeles do read what I have to say about their movies, and they do respond, and I hear from them often. But you can't worry too much about, you know, the mechanical things like that, about the industry and screenings and the rest of it. I reject private screenings. I just don't want them. I don't want to be beholden. And that alienates them. That makes them feel they can't get me in their debt. And they like to do things for you like that, because then they feel you'll do them a good turn when they've got a movie that the head of the company is particularly high on. Well, I think it's important not to be in their good graces. But so far as influence on critics, the amazing thing is that I can, you know, pan a movie and run into critics who tell me how much they agree with me, and I'll open their papers and they'll have given it a rave. And I don't want to try to think that out too clearly. I just assume not.
When you realized that you really loved movies and that they were important to you, did you want to make movies, or did you know right away that you wanted to be a film critic and write about movies?
Oh, no. Even the thought of criticism came very late. I went to movies all my childhood. That was before the rating system kept kids out, and it was also before the era, really, of babysitters. We were a large farm family, and we all went. I was carried by my older brothers and sisters or my parents, and so I really saw movies from a very, very early age. And I did remember them very well. I remembered them better than my older brothers and sisters, which always sort of surprised them. But it wasn't until fairly late in life that I started writing movie criticism. And it was just one of those fluky things you start doing when you're trying to make a living at home. I had tried to do other kinds of writing, and I'd sort of experimented with other kinds of writing, writing plays and essays and all. But the movie criticism started really when I was, I guess, my late 20s, early 30s. But I didn't get a professional job until much later. I was already 46 or 47 before I ever started making any money at it. When I did the radio show, I wasn't a paid contributor to Pacific. I was one of their guests. And I enjoyed writing about movies, though, and I enjoyed talking about them. And my style seemed to fall into place more easily on movies. For one thing, I'm interested in all the arts, and I think all those factors came into play. I'm interested in the theater and in opera and in painting and music. And somehow or other, movies are a way to use all of that. And I've always been interested in social and political things, and that too comes into it.
You didn't start writing film criticism full-time, really, for a living until you were in your mid-40s. What were some of the jobs you held before then? Were they all movie jobs?
No, some of them were. I mean, I did manage theaters very successfully for a period. I started the whole twin cinema idea in the country, which I regret now.
It's given way to the quadruple.
That's right, and the more than that.
That's right.
I've done everything from working as a seamstress to working as a cook, taking care of children. I've done just a lot of crazy jobs, some of them because I had a child who needed heart surgery and who was in very bad shape, and so I couldn't put her in a nursery school. And so I took a lot of jobs that may have seemed very lowly because things I could do at home, I did a lot of. But I also did things related to movies. I programmed movies for colleges and wrote the notes for the colleges and wrote advertising copy for theaters on the West Coast and wrote catalogs for 16-millimeter distributors, all those dreary jobs. On the other hand, a lot of them I learned how to loosen up my style, and that wasn't so bad. Advertising copy can be useful in that because since it isn't going to be signed, you don't feel the same constraint you would if you were working on something you thought, this is my definitive statement.
When you started writing film criticism in your 40s, you were already a mature person. You didn't have to prove your identity in the same way that a young person starting out would. And I wonder if you think it affected your style at all, bringing the maturity that you did to your writing.
Oh, I think I had more assurance than a lot of critics who subsequently started getting jobs right out of college and who were hired to be film critics because they were hotshot kids on the school paper or because they wanted to be movie critics. I wasn't as susceptible to advertisers' flattery. For one thing, I had the experience of managing theaters for 5 years. I tend to be a rather independent person in my judgments anyway. I always have been. But I wasn't about to kowtow to anybody else's superior taste. And that so much of that is a matter of character. I think there are some brilliant people doing criticism who often don't do anything like the job they could do because they don't have that confidence in their taste.
You're one of the very few women of your generation to be a film critic. Did being a woman stand in your way at all?
Well, there were a lot of women working on newspapers. Very often they were the editors or the owners, sister-in-law or somebody else in the family who either wanted the job or else couldn't do anything else. But they weren't taken very seriously. There were some very, very good women critics who worked on the small magazines. Louise Bogan, the poet, was for a while a very fine movie critic. And, of course, there was a long tradition of literary women writing from time to time about the movies. The English novelist Dorothy Richardson, Virginia Woolf wrote pieces on the movies. A great many writers who we don't think of in terms of movies actually wrote about them. But there weren't serious-minded movie critics working in a public way, not on any large circulation magazine or paper. Judith Crist had quite a following in New York, but of course she's a very, very different tradition. She comes out of reporting and journalism, and she's a very tough, direct writer. I don't think she would, spend paragraphs analyzing the kind of things that interested me. And I don't think until that period anybody would have given me the chance. I was lucky in the sense that movies were becoming complex and ambiguous at the same time that I was getting a start as a movie critic. Before that, in San Francisco, I never could get a professional job because they didn't think their readers would be interested in any kind of analytic criticism. And they may have been right.
You have a new book that's out called State of the Art. Now, of your books, it's really, aside from the book on Orson Welles, it's the only book of your collected movie reviews that doesn't have a sexually tinged title to it. There's Going Steady, I Lost It at the Movies, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Deeper into Movies, and now State of the Art. How come that one stands out without having a sexual title?
Well, for one thing, I felt it was inappropriate in terms of my advancing years. But no, it's really the kind of movies that are being made now. This is not a year in which the movies have, a period in which the movies have been very sexy or sensual or all out there. This is not a movie period with The Last Tango or A Mean Streets. There's no movie with that kind of sensual feeling to it. And to I wouldn't want to use that kind of title when it no longer described the contents of the book. I use the title State of the Art ironically because, of course, the state of the art is excruciatingly low at the moment. The pictures are really at a kind of standstill, except for a very few people who are pushing to do the best work they can. There has been no advance in movie art that I could see in the last few years, and it seemed more honest to say so rather than to try to hype up the movies of the period.
Were the sexual allusions of your earlier titles conscious?
Oh, of course. You can't really say I lost it at the movies and not be aware of what you're saying. No, I'm a perfectly conscious person.
Why'd you do it?
Because movies are so sexual to us, and I felt it was a way of getting at what we really go to movies for. That's a big factor in it, that sensual feeling you get at the movies, and also the fact that the actors and actresses we respond to in very, very personal ways. I mean, some of them we really want to see because they evoke all kinds of feelings in us, and others we can't tolerate because for people they do evoke feelings and they don't want to have to deal with them. But I think because movies are an art form that is so eclectic, because it takes in so many of the other arts, it can affect us in very subconscious and unconscious ways. And a lot of that is sensual. I think it's one of the reasons why people like to read movie criticism, because often they're so affected emotionally that they want to read a critic to sort out their reactions and find out if they were unusual or if other people reacted the same way or why they were so upset by a given movie. There are a lot of ways in which movies affect us, even simple movies that are really not quite at our surface conscious level.
Because you have to report all the time on your own emotional reactions to a movie and your more intellectual reactions to the movie, does it ever dim your own passion for the film? Do you lose the passion when you're always reviewing and reporting on
films? No, I think you're more steeped in it because writing about a movie, trying to evoke the sensations of that particular film, you re-experience them, and you experience them more acutely. I mean, I think writing seriously about anything you care about, you get to like it more, not less. I love seeing a good movie because then I know I will have the fun of trying to share that experience with other people. I never go to a movie wanting it to be bad. I always go wanting it to be good because then I'll have something new to say. I mean, an innovative movie means I'll have something new to write about. And that's the most exciting part of being a critic.
That was film critic Pauline Kael. Pauline Kael's latest collection of reviews is titled State of the Art. It's published by Dutton. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Barron and Dan Lachlan. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.